told to produce more power. Good morning, sisters. Please find your seats. Oh, wow, that was beautiful.
All caps. Great job, sister.
Yesterday, as we were hearing beautifully from Father Basil Cole on the theological and philosophical foundations of obedience, how we have been created in a certain sense to obey, already our formation minds were beginning to question, but how do we apply this to our novice? And what would you do, Father, in this instance? And what would it look like this way? How wonderful it is to find someone to present to us today on the topic of human formation as it regards the vow of obedience. She has a great understanding of the human person as created in the image of God, associated with a keen knowledge of the psychology that makes us all tick. And as she applies that psychology to the human person, it's always with the understanding of what does the gospel message tell us? She studied at St. Louis University and received her Bachelor of Arts there, along with her PhD. She is currently the coordinator of human formation services and the professor of pastoral counseling at Kenrick Glennon Seminary, where she has been since 1990. Her almost 25 years in formation work with the seminarians has certainly prepared her to be able to speak to us today, and I can assure you, she still knows how to speak Feminese. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Suzanne Harbeth.
Thank you, Sister Mary Joseph, but you don't have to call me Dr. Harbeth. Only my children have to call me Dr. Harbeth. It is such a pleasure to be here today, and I ask the Lord to open my lips that my mouth may proclaim his praise. I'd like to just start with a little reading from Wisdom, and just bear with me. I always begin with prayer. Send wisdom forth, O Lord, from your holy heavens, and from your glorious thrones dispatch her, that she may be with me and work with me and with all of us, that we may know what is your pleasure. For she, Wisdom, knows and understands all things and will guide us very discreetly in our affairs and safeguard us by her glory. Amen. Amen. Well, it is really a pleasure to be here. As I look out on this audience, it's kind of difficult for me. I'm kind of squinting, where are all the men? Because 25 years in seminary formation, that's a long time. And it's such a pleasure to be able to speak to women for a change, to address my gender. And yes, sister, I was giving a female conference several years ago on, actually it was a retreat for women, and I was presenting with a priest from the seminary. And during the break, he took me aside and he said, "Oh my gosh, you speak Feminese." Thank you, sister, for reminding us of that. He had never heard me do that before. He said, "I'm so used to hearing you address men. So different. I didn't know. I forget sometimes that you're a woman." So I don't know if that was good or bad. I really don't. So it's nice to be among my own gender. My husband and I raised three sons. All of our animals, all of our pets were male. That was what my boys said. We can only have boy dogs. And the greatest success they had with our dogs was that they taught one of our dogs to burp on command. So I think you get a general idea of where I'm coming from. Nice to be able to go into a restroom that doesn't say male on the outside. You know, things like that, just little things. But it's been quite a pleasure. It's been an absolute blessing in my life to be able to be involved in formation work. Now, a sister was telling you, my background is really in the field of psychology, And so I had been very involved in the St. Louis area in some ministry in the pro-life movement. I was doing a lot of radio and TV programs and things like that for the pro-life movement and doing a lot of lobbying work. And, you know, you do your ministry and then you get to the point where you say, I think my ideas, I'm running out of ideas. There are younger people, there are newer people, there are other people that should share in the joy of this ministry. And so you begin to move forward and you begin to leave behind your old work and to search for something new. So I really prayed to the Lord that He would use whatever He had given me as whatever He saw fit as my gifts, and that He would use me. And I really deeply prayed that He would find me a ministry that was suiting and pleasing to Him. So I was called. I received a call to formation. Now, my call, it did come from God, I like to think, but it came more directly from a priest about this tall. Many of you may know him. He is now Archbishop George Lucas. He was then Father Lucas, and he was a very good friend of mine. And he called me and he said, Archbishop May wants you to come to Kenrick Seminary to teach and to do formation work. Of course, I just laughed. I said, oh, okay, that's funny. You know, how have you been? He said, no, I'm serious. I said, oh, come on, you've got to be kidding me. I said, that's absolutely ridiculous. I don't know anything about the seminary. I said, and I know enough priests to know that I do not want to be somebody's bad professor story. I've heard so many of those. And so I really tried so hard to convince him, and I said, you know, George, I said, I haven't taught for a long time. In fact, my only teaching experience was teaching emotionally disturbed adolescent boys. You know what George Lucas said. So anyway, here I came to formation work, not really understanding it, and walking in the building and saying to the then Vincentians who ran Kenrick Seminary, as you may know, we are preparing men for the diocesan priesthood, and we're a regional seminary. We're now run by the Diocese of St. Louis. We were run originally by the Vincentians, God bless them, for so many years. And I came there in 1990 under the last of the Vincentians. It was a real honor to work with them. But I didn't know anything about formation work. I had no idea what this was all about. And so I was always saying to people, what does this mean, formation work? What are we supposed to be doing here? And, you know, over the years, I was able to piece that together with the help of some very good Vincentians. But basically, formation work is transformation work, isn't it? It's just work that is calling us more closely to the life of Christ. It's work that is calling us in union with Him. And it is God calling us accountable for God. He's calling us to be accountable to Him first, to be then accountable to those to whom we're going to serve and to minister. And it is by cooperating with His work that we enter into that process of formation. What I quickly learned in the formation process is that God put me in formation and that I was in the formation process as well. And in order to really understand that, I think the scripture that says, because I have been crucified with Christ, I no longer live, but He lives in me. That's on my lips almost every day, that I no longer live, but He lives in me. That is my hope and my prayer for myself in the formation process and trying so hard to configure myself first to Christ. Now, I'm supposed to give you today, and my third talk is going to deal primarily with us as formators. And I've learned a lot. I can speak to you with great relevance on this topic, primarily because I've made probably every mistake in the book. So that's the best way to learn, right? So I have some good things I hope to say to you that are pointers, at least maybe to help you avoid some of the pitfalls that I've probably fell in myself in my many years of working in the formation process. You know, Paul says to the Galatians that we should correct with a gentle spirit, looking to yourself so that you also may not be tempted. What a beautiful instruction. And, you know, the instruction to the Galatians is so relevant today. It's still very relevant. And the Galatians were a unique group of people, right? And Paul's address to them was very unique, and it was unique for their time and for their place. And so I want to begin today in looking at who are our Galatians today? Who are the Galatians of 2014? Who are these young women who are coming to us and who are giving us this opportunity to enter into their lives. And what a gift that is, to enter into someone's life. What a trust they put in us. They put that trust, of course, in the Lord, but they look at us every day and they see us and they put their trust in us. So understanding these Galatians. So I want to talk a little bit about this younger generation and the women that are coming to us in formation today. Because I've been at the seminary for almost 25 years, and I think it's probably been within the last 10 years that I've seen the greatest changes in those individuals who are coming to us. And so I want to talk a little bit about that, just to point that out to you, maybe give you some insight so that you don't think you're losing your mind. I mean, you might be losing your mind, but, you know, in addition to that, we want to make sure that we have an understanding. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the nature part of us, which is how we're wired, you know. What is it in us? We're all wired differently. Some of us are crockpots and some of us are microwaves, right? And we just deal with our emotions and everything so much differently than the person sitting next to us. And how to reverence that, to be able to reverence that in formation work. Because we can't make people obey us, right? We all know that. And the Lord knows that he doesn't make people obey him either. You know, there's that story about the perfect father who had some good kids. He had two really good kids. And he left for a while. And he said, okay, I'm going to be gone for a little while. And there's a couple things I don't want you to do while I'm gone. So, you know, do whatever you want, but just don't do these few little things. So this perfect father went away for a while. And when he came back, he found out his kids had done exactly what he told them not to do. And their names were Adam and Eve. So we want to remember that we are wired, you know, with free will. And that we want to help these candidates and these young women, these novices, these postulants, we want to help them configure themselves to Christ because that is their desire, not because that's our desire. If you've ever said the words, because I told you so, that's why, you know how ineffective that is, right? And you probably walk away saying, I cannot believe I opened my mouth and my mother's words came out. How did that happen? How did that happen to me? So some of them are crackpots, some of them are microwaves, and some of them are crackpots. And some of us are crackpots, right? We're all crackpots because the Lord works with earthen vessels. So let's talk a little bit about this newer generation that the Lord is blessing us with, these wonderful young women that are coming to us out of a culture that is probably pretty different than the culture that most of us are used to having grown up in. And if you've worked in formation for a while, you know, as I know, that there's a big difference. All of a sudden, there's a bump in the curve. It's a little different. This is a different type of individual that the Lord has sent to us. So let's talk about these people. These are the Gen Y, the Generation Y people, often referred to as the millennials. Now, pejoratively, they've been referred to as the teacup kids for their emotional fragility. Now, some of you may say, uh-huh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Also referred to as the boomerang kids. Why? Because a third of these kids will end up at some time going home and living with their parents. Often referred to as the trophy kids. Why the trophy kids? Because everyone in their generation is a winner, right? Everyone gets a trophy. Everyone gets a trophy. First place team and the last place team. I remember at one point one of my sons was on a team and he got the trophy. This was playing baseball. For the kid who got hit in the head the most times with the ball. I mean, I laughed so hard I cried. I thought, this is ridiculous. But, you know, the trophy kids, everyone's a winner. And there's good in these things. But, you know, there's always water over that dam. A little bit of water over the dam. Also referred to as the Peter Pan generation. The generation that has been pampered, that has been overpraised. The generation that is relentlessly self-confident. There you go. That's interesting, isn't it? And do you think that could have something to do with obedience, perhaps? These are individuals who are growing up at a slower pace than many of us did. They're growing up at a much slower pace than many of us did. Now, like the generation before them, Generation X, they were raised in two-income families. But they had a phenomenon that Generation X didn't have. They had helicopter parents. They called them helicopter parents, who spent so much time and effort with their children, involved in their lives, their schedules, all of their activities. So since birth, these kids, these young adults now that are presenting themselves to us for formation, are very autonomous. They've been offered autonomy, control, and choices since birth. Here's something that will resonate with you. They are used to seeing their elders as peers, right? I'm seeing a lot of head nodding now, right? We're their peers. Their parents are their friends. They're not afraid to ask for what they want. So they're not, we're going to talk about this in a minute, but depending upon where we're coming from, we're going to define them quite differently through our own eyes, correct? In the workplace, they're called the no-collar workers. Isn't that interesting? Why? Because about 80% of them want to set their own time schedules. 8 to 10, 8 to 4, oh no. Now, how about if I come in at noon, I work for a couple hours, I go for a run, and I'll come back after dinner. And we're, you know, they're setting their own time. It's not a bad thing necessarily, but it's different. 70% of them tell us that they need more me time.
Yeah.
Ah, that got like a little chord on that one, huh? And believe it or not, 90% of this is Pew Research, by the way, 90% of them believe they deserve their dream job right out of college. That's why so many of them aren't working, because they don't have their dream job. They expect to walk in. I have a niece who is working in the field of advertising. I think almost every kid that graduates nowadays has a degree in communications and advertising. And, you know, she's already left three different jobs because she went to work and they made her do boring stuff. I said, well, what did you expect? Did you expect to walk in and for them to say, here's the Coca-Cola logo. We'd like you to redesign it for us, please. You know, it's a different sense of who they are and what they deserve in the workplace. 41% of these individuals are going to get monetary help from their parents, and 40% are going to move back home at some place. The workplace is changing to meet their needs. Businesses like Apple are making accommodations. Bring your dogs to work. Wear your flip-flops to work. You know, do your yoga. Lie on the floor. Take a nap. You know, how do you want to work? Work the way that works best for you. Maybe it's not such a bad thing, but it's very different than what we're used to. The biggest problem with Generation Y, perhaps, might be that sense of entitlement. And you know what? The older generations, those who have parented these children into this type of behavior, it's our fault. We did it, right? This is what we taught them about themselves. So I don't know about the rest of you, but is anybody beginning to hear that chorus from Bye Bye Birdie? What's the matter with kids today? Why can't they be like we were, perfect in every way? Right? So the culture has really shaped them, and it's touched each and every one of them. And this is what we're being presented with. It's very different.
The mic went out.
I'm sorry, the mic went out? It did go out. I can project. Can you hear me? Oh, he's recording. This one's gone too. Okay, we're going to get a new battery, so you can just hum What's the Matter with Kids Today. Hum that to yourself for a while, right? Okay, we back in business?
This one may go too. I'll put new
okay, we'll try it again. So they're different. It's not better, it's not worse, because every generation has left an effect on the world. And every generation has brought good things to the world and great challenges to the world. So it's not necessarily better or worse, it's just a different way of approaching this younger generation and what we're going to do for them. You know, Generation X, the generation of the 30s, the 40-year-olds, that 40 getting into the 50-year-olds, would be willing to see their boss or their supervisor or their mother superior as an authority or an expert. Nowadays, this newer generation, sister's laughing because she knows, right? They have been raised to believe that their voice is just as good as our voice, that their opinion is just as good as our opinion. It's not unusual for someone from this generation to walk into the CEO on their first day on the job and speak their mind. It goes straight to the top. So they may be doing that to you in your convents, in your houses of formation. They're going over the heads of superiors because the spirit doesn't understand them. So they go to the provincial, or they go to the top. You know, if you asked Generation X to jump, they'd say, how high? If we asked Generation Y to jump, they say, why? What do you want me to do that for? They've been raised to question authority. So for our formation challenges, what about respect for elders? Why are you questioning us? Why do you question what we're doing? Why do you not see our experiences as valid? Why do you not follow our directives? Why do you always want to find a new way to do something? Right? These are some of the challenges that they're presenting to us. So every generation has had its impact. We just need to try to understand them and to work with the strengths that the Lord has provided for them. In terms of motivation, Generation X were very independent workers, but they were dutiful workers, and they were hard workers. Generation Y is putting purpose for work at the top of the list. What's the purpose of it? Why am I doing that? What's going to be the outcome? And, you know, that's not a bad question to be asking. But if we're coming from a generation where you listen to your elders and obedience means you do it when I say to do it, and we find ourselves saying, because I said so, that's why you do it, then this is going to cause some difficulties for us in our formational programs. Generation X, they lived to work. It was all about working. Generation Y works to live. It's all about the me time, the off time, the downtime. It's not about money or titles for them. In fact, they will be much less rich than their parents before them, which is kind of unusual. Usually it's an upward climb. But they're not interested in that. They're more interested in the intrinsic value of the work, the meaning of the work. However, they have less of a sense of group affiliation and community or company loyalty. You know, if you look at resumes from people who've been on the job market in the prior generations, people stay with companies for 50 years. Look at me, 25 years at the seminary. You know, nowadays, it's all a matter of, no, they don't meet my needs. And so resumes nowadays, and you might be noticing this as you're looking at incoming candidates, are very different. A year here, a year there, 6 months here, 2 years here. And we would think, perhaps, with our advanced ages, some of us are very young, but, you know, what does that mean? They can't hold a job? Well, what it means is that they don't really value group affiliation as much as we did. It's much more independent. There's much less loyalty to those kinds of groups. Where the generation before them was very motivated by, you know, the structure of the work week, Generation Y is very motivated by autonomy. They want to do things on their own. And so oftentimes they go off and they do something, right? And you say, why did you do that? Or why didn't you tell me you did that? Or why didn't you ask permission to do that? Because they're raised in the system of autonomy. They want to work their way. They want to do things quickly. And they want to do multiple things. They get bored. Have you noticed how bored they tell you they are? I'm bored. I'm bored. And because they want to multitask. They are the most educated generation, and that's something to be honored in them. They are very educated. You know, I heard on the news this morning, and this is something that blew my mind, a 3-year-old child, her pregnant mother, had a seizure. The 3-year-old child found her mother's cell phone, unlocked it, and dialed 911. Are you kidding me? When I was 3 years old... I don't even think I knew how to dial my Fisher-Price phone. And here, this is a different generation. This is a very different generation. They're very educated. They're also very used to feedback. You know they are. Facebook, tweeting, Twittering, you know. I'm walking down the hall now. I'm going to, you know, put on my boots. Oh, 15 friends. Good for you. Where are you going? You know, it's like a commentary on my life constantly. And I'm so used to feedback. I'm so used to feedback. The retail people say that when kids buy things nowadays, they go in the dressing room, they take a picture of themselves, and then they tweet it to all their friends. Do you like this on me? How do I look? What do you think? And they don't buy it until they get a bunch of those thumbs up things in terms of an answer. It's wonderful for evangelization. And the Holy Father has pointed that out. But they're very used to feedback. They're asking us for feedback all the time. So they're kind of funny, aren't they? Because they're not really needy and dependent on us, but they really want that feedback, and they expect it. And if we don't give the feedback, well, what does that mean? That means we don't care. We don't think they're doing a good job. We're not a loving mother superior or a loving novice mistress. You know, they want to do their own thing, their own way. And that's the context in which they've been raised. So they're very open-minded, very, very confident. And let's look at the Catholic millennials particularly, because there's some things about Catholic millennials that I think are very, very interesting. You know, people have said to me working at the seminary, oh, the seminarians are just, aren't they just so conservative and old-fashioned now? And I said, no, they're not. Oh, well, they're all carrying their rosaries around, and they're all, you know, they're all joining religious orders where sisters are in habit, and they're all, you know, everybody, this whole generation, they're all so conservative. They're not conservative, but they do have some special things about you that I would like to tell you that I think explain that Catholic millennial behavior. They see themselves as special, right? Trophy kids, everybody's special. And so for them, Catholicism is very special. It's very special. They wear it like a badge of honor. They're proud of it. That's beautiful, right? They're proud of it. They want to gather in the quadrangle at a non-Catholic college and pray the rosary because they're proud of their Catholicism. It's special because they believe they are special. They have been sheltered, right? They have been sheltered. That's why so many of them are still sheltered, living at home with parents. So they seek shelter in God. There's nothing wrong with that. That's not a bad thing. That's not ultra-conservatism. That's the right attitude. We should all be seeking shelter in God. They're very connected. But their idea of Catholicism is to evangelize. It's to get out there and say what the Lord means to them and to tell as many people as possible. So that's why the message of a Holy Father like Pope Francis is so important to these young people. He's speaking their language, evangelization. Wow, he's awesome, right? And the last part is that they need to feel very appreciated. We know that about this generation, and they need a lot of feedback. So they're seeking that. They're seeking, they're very open-minded. They're very questioning. And you know that most of us, in generationally, as we've left college, we all came to that point where we had to say, do I want the faith of my fathers? Do I want their faith? And kids nowadays are doing that, but they're not affiliating as quickly as some of us affiliated. You know, we might have had 2 weeks of saying to our parents, I don't think I'm going to church anymore. And after we were locked in a room for, you know, 2 solid weeks without food or water, we said, you know, Mom, I changed my mind. I think I do want to go back to math. Well, this group is unaffiliated for longer periods of time. But when they're coming back, they are seeking things like the Latin Mass and the more devotional practices of the church. But why are they seeking that? Not because they're so conservative, but they're looking for the original forms. They're looking for authenticity. You know what? This generation doesn't like the guitar masses and the praise music. That's hokey to them. They're looking for the real deal. And that's exactly what they're in search of. So that's what we're finding. So, you know, all of this put together it forms the influences of the culture, but then there's this thing we call our personal culture, right? Our personal culture. And my first culture is my family. And the families are changing. We know that. You know, it used to be in the olden days of the seminary when I first started there, you know, everybody came from a wonderful Catholic intact family with at least a dozen kids, you know, and everybody's parents were so happy that their son was going to be a priest. Nowadays, the families are broken. There's divorce. There's single parents. There actually are young people born out of wedlock, you know, and they feel a great burden on themselves having been, you know, conceived that way. There are people who have lived apart from their parents from very early ages because of dysfunction in the homes. So there's a tremendous amount of that going on. And more often than not, there are mothers and fathers who oppose their sons being in the seminary. That's very different. You know, on family day, it's sparse. Much more sparse than it was. And what you'll find is when I go from table to table to meet the families, this is my neighbor, this is someone I met at the Newman Center. They're not the intact families we used to have. So that personal culture is different. So we all come out of a personal culture, and we all establish a meaning of what that was about. We all try to figure out, what was this about? What was this about? And so in developing this personal meaning, and you've heard of this, it's called our sometimes we call it a life script, or we call it a schema, or we call it our life plan, or our modus operandi, call it whatever you will. But these are patterns that we develop in childhood, and they continue through life. They're not immutable, but we don't forget them. We don't forget them. So here's how it works. When we're born, they hand us a computer, and they say, here's your computer. Now, here's your job. You look around the world and you bring in all the data you can to answer two questions. Who am I, and how does the world work? Those are the two questions we're searching for, right? Who am I? How does the world work? Now, we would like to think that we all opened our Baltimore Catechism and read all the, you know, I love the old-fashioned Baltimore Catechism. I don't know, some of you are mature enough to remember that, you know. Had a lot of pictures in it that were quite interesting now by today's standards. But, you know, who am I? Who am I? And how does this world work? So where do we get these beliefs? Well, it would be nice if we had studied the catechism. It would be nice if we had intact homes and we had good Catholic parents who were schooling us in this. Or even that we went to Catholic schools. Many of our men in preparation for the priesthood haven't been in Catholic schools. Some of them are converts, fairly new converts. So where do we get all these beliefs about the world? These observations, these experiences, these are things we were told, things people said to us, and we input them into our computer. So who am I? I'm Daddy's little princess. I'm special. I'm wonderful, right? That's who I am. And then Mother brings home this screaming little bundle of joy called my baby brother, right? And now I'm a deposed princess. What does that mean about me? What does that mean? How does the world work? Let me figure this out. Oh, I get it. He cries and he gets attention. So I think I'll try that, right? So I pitch a fit. I cry. Mom comes running. I get attention. I'm back on top. That's how the world works. Now, those are the musings of a child. But I've been a therapist long enough to tell you that those musings of a child drive our behavior in childhood, and guess what? They drive that behavior right into adulthood. So many of us are still acting on these childhood belief systems. We understand that we get our way when we become aggressive. We could become a bully. Many of us do that. We learn that in childhood, and we're still doing it. Some of us learn that when we act hurt and upset, that we get attention. So many of us develop life schemas about being a victim. And that's the way our world works. So if you tell me I did something wrong, Mother Superior, then I just whimper and I say, you're always picking on me. And then you feel sorry for me. And you soothe me and I say, that's how the world works. Because remember, that computer I was given is my brain. It's all recorded up here. It's all recorded up here. So we record these beliefs, and they drive our behavior. They drive us into behaving in certain ways. One thing we know about human behavior is that it's purposeful. It is not random. So everything we do for a reason. Everything we do for a reason. Now, sometimes those reasons are unconscious. We don't think them through. We don't walk in a room and say, oh, it's dark. Didn't Thomas Edison invent a light bulb? There's usually light switches on a wall. If I retract my, my bicep, I could turn my arm to flip it. We don't think that through. We don't think that through. That becomes an automatic pattern. We call those neuron firing patterns, just quick little patterns. I do the same thing with my belief systems that are unspoken. I learn things like, they love you because of what you do. So automatically, I have to do, right? Or I learn things like, you get punished if you get angry. So I never get angry. Or conflict is bad. So I run from conflict. I don't even think about it. I just do it. And I continue those patterns. So we develop these patterns of behaviors, mostly in childhood. And it is completely plausible that our adult behavior is driven by a lot of these childhood beliefs, right? And we repeat these patterns. We repeat these patterns in life. If the belief was that conflict is bad, then we shrunk from conflict as a child, and we will shrink from conflict as an adult, unless we do something about these patterns. We also recreate the conditions of these patterns, right? Is it interesting to you that some people who are in a victim schema in life, everybody's always picking on them. Isn't that interesting? Because why? We recreate these patterns, and we are drawn to conditions that trigger those patterns. We're drawn to the conditions that trigger those patterns. And here's the part that's important for all of us. We lure other people into our patterns, right? We get lured into it. But here's the rub. They have their patterns, and guess what? We have our patterns, right? And so this is a condition for potential difficulty and formation, especially in areas like obedience. They believe they should be affirmed. This is their life schema. I believe you should affirm me when I do the right thing. What do we believe? We might believe, are you kidding me? No one affirmed me when I was growing up. You do the right thing, suck it up, right? It's the way the world works. That's in my schema. So sometimes our schemas, right, they're just banging up against each other. So we need to learn to see their schemas. We need to observe them and try to understand what is motivating these behaviors, correct? But more importantly, and we'll talk about this more in the third talk, we need to understand ourselves. We have many distorted beliefs that got into that computer, ourselves. And if you're sitting there and you're saying, I don't have any illogical beliefs in my head, then what I want to say to you is, that is your first illogical belief. Sometimes when these schemas are harmful, they produce situations that reoccur over and over and over again. And they fall into all kinds of different categories. One of the categories they fall into is things like abandonment. No one loves me. No one really cares about me. Do you know people who are operating out of that schema? Or maybe this one. I had problems with trust as a child. Mom was an alcoholic. I don't trust people. And so maybe that's a life schema that is coming your way through some of the young candidates that you're dealing with. A great life schema perhaps of dependency. I cannot do it alone. In fact, this Generation Y has produced a whole new category developmentally that we've not seen before. We had adolescence and we had adulthood. Now we have a category because of Generation Y called emerging adulthood. Emerging adulthood. So they're stalling out. It's a developmental lag. And much to our chagrin and theirs as well, they're not crossing that threshold into adulthood. So even though there are many things that buoy them forward, there's a great sense of vulnerability and dependence. How about emotionally? Emotional or social exclusion? I just don't fit in. I'm different. You don't understand me. I'm a different person. I'm not like you. Well, that could be true. But if I don't fit in anywhere, if that's my life schema, that's a big problem for formation work. Or how about defectiveness? I'm a failure. Everything I touch fails. Well, you know, that's a schema that we see in many young people. It holds them back. If you believe that everything you're going to do is going to create failure, of course you're going to act out of that belief. You're going to avoid things. You're going to avoid responsibility. And you're going to deny responsibility when people come to you and say, you did this and it was wrong. Could you try it again? I didn't do that, right? And you know, God is good, so many times we get more than one life trap, you know? So we get to have the life trap of, I want to avoid failure, and then when I get corrected, no one loves me, right? A lot of our candidates have the subjugation life trap. A lot of work on, I must be perfect, I must be perfect, I must be perfect. And when I have a student that comes in my office and says, I'm a perfectionist, I say, oh, I'm so sorry you're delusional. And then I'll say, what do you think was the original sin? Was that about being perfect? Huh, let's go back and read Genesis again, right? Or how about a sense of entitlement life trap? I am special. Not I'm different, but I'm special. And I deserve to be treated specially. You know, in looking at the work that has been problematic in the priest abuse scandal, one of the major attributors to that is narcissism, is that sense that I'm special and I'm different. I don't fit in because I'm special, right? So in talk two, we're going to look at some of these more distorted life schemas and their impact on us. And then we're going to take some time to kind of figure out how they evolve and how they might cause us some difficulty. So, you know, we might be thinking at this point, you know, all these challenges, you know, their generation, their culture, their beliefs, my beliefs, who's right, who's wrong, you know. I just want us all to remember and to put our faith in the Lord and remember that it doesn't matter if we're Generation X or we're baby boomers or we're Generation Y or whatever the heck we might be, we all have the same goal in formation work. And that is that we decrease so that he may increase in us. I want to end this talk by just saying that as we approach the work of formation and we're exposed to all these challenges that our formees present to us, it is easy to become discouraged at our woundedness and at their woundedness. But I find great consolation in the words of Jacques Philippe in his book, Time for God. Many of you know him. He's a wonderful author. And Jacques Philippe says, God is less concerned to make us perfect than to attach us firmly to himself. One sort of perfection would make us self-sufficient and independent. Being wounded in this way makes us poorer, but brings us into communion with God. And that is what counts, not attaining ideal perfection, but being unable to do without God. Being constantly bound to him by our wretchedness as much as by our virtues, so that his love can pour itself into us unceasingly and somehow give ourselves entirely to him because we understand we have no alternative. Thank you, sisters. Sister Mary Joseph is my boss. I have to listen to her. What do I do now, sister? 15 minutes of questions. Okay, sure.
And answers.
Oh, and answers. Oh, you wanted answers. Okay. See, that's it. You have to be pretty specific with people, don't you? Does any of this resonate with you? Maybe we could begin with that. Tell me what I said that resonated with you. Maybe that's a good way to start us off. Sister, perhaps you could say your question and I'll repeat it for
okay,
the group.
Well, I can project.
Thank you.
Can you hear me over there by the window? See what I mean? First of all, thank you so much. Everything you said resonated with me.
Thank you.
I didn't say you described me, but anyway, I want to thank you, first of all. Secondly, you described some of my novices, you described my nephew. I guess my question would be, it seems to me, our generation, there's a way that we can continue to enable these things that we're talking about.
Yes.
I'm a high school teacher. We talk about outcome-based education. That's one of the big buzzwords in education right now. We have a number of my students are on, for example, travel teams. Parents let their kids go on travel teams. They don't have opportunities.
They don't have opportunities to build relationships.
Yes.
Because they're constantly changing from one team to the next. But how do we not enable these things to continue to go on? But I also want to say, I like what you said, how do we work with them and what is positive about what they have? I think that was an excellent point as well.
Yes. I'm going to, in my second talk, I hope to address a little bit more of some of the ways that we can become involved with them. Because everything about this generation isn't good. Everything about our generations wasn't good. And remember, we started with Galatians, to correct with a gentle spirit, looking to yourself so you also may not be tempted. And the reason I love that is because what Paul is telling us is, you know, don't get in there and do the same things that they're doing. You know, stand back and do what is right and holy. And so, I think that we want to bring them back to, again, here's what I always say, and I will say this in the talk as well, but everything we need to know, the Lord has taught us. Everything. And I always tell my students, when you're giving instruction, everything is preceded by the words, "It is written." Right? So all we need to do is look at the gospel and say, you know, what does the Lord say about loving each other, about being present with each other, about relationship? It's all there. So we need to continually point them there. You know, leaders don't come with their own agenda. So we are here as leaders, not with our agenda, but with His agenda. We're St. John the Baptist. We're saying, look, He's coming. He's coming. It's over here. It's over here. And so I really think pointing them, sister, to ideals is the best way. If we approach them like, well, my generation didn't have 500 friends on Facebook, you know, then that just turns them off. You know, and we can't tell them what they're doing in the world they're living in is wrong because we think it's wrong. We can only admonish or correct because the Lord thinks it's wrong. And so I really think that's our strength, is pointing to the gospel. And I tell my students, do this, not because I said so, because that's hollow, we already talked about that, but because He said so, the Lord said so. So that's the best I can offer on that one. Thank you, sister.
Doctor, at one point in time you said that this particular generation is the most educated and then that they are used to having feedback, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or whatnot. I'm also a high school teacher, and I realize although they're educated in the particular area that they like, they're not very educated in all across the board. And when it comes to wanting feedback from their friends, that's one aspect, but they don't like feedback from the ones who have the authority. So how is it that you can approach the situation where when you want to incorporate an understanding that goes deeper than just the superficial level of what they know and make them think that they know it, but they really don't know it?
Yeah. Well, and that's a good question, and I will speak to part of that, and if I'm not answering it, interrupt me again. But I think there's so much general knowledge out there but there's a little bit of knowledge about a lot of things, but there's not a real understanding. It breaks my heart that I can't say to my own children, and my children had Jesuit, very expensive Jesuit education, let me tell you. Through high school and through college, I had three sons in Jesuit education at the same time. But it breaks my heart that I can't quote I can't even quote literature to them. You know, I can't say, well, remember in To Kill a Mockingbird, they look at me like, what? Didn't you read that? And yeah, I guess we did. You know, there's not an integration. And, you know, many years ago, I think when I was in college, a long time ago, I heard Margaret Mead speak. Do you all remember who Margaret Mead is? Okay. And Margaret Mead said, the generations to come will be educated but uneducated. And here's why. She said, because information has so collapsed. Now remember, this was when I was in college, this was in the 70s, okay, a long time ago. So this was way before, the internet was invented. So this was way before that explosion of information. But she said, can you believe that when I was in college, Margaret Mead speaking, we learned about square root in college courses. They're teaching square root in second and third grade now. And that was in the 70s. So the information is so collapsed, isn't it? But you can't know that much. And so most of my students will tell me, you don't really have to know anything. You have to have a general idea of where you can find the information. So there's so little integration, which is what I fear. You know, and I think that our goal is to integrate. And to ask them, what does that mean? Why are you studying that? You know, you don't have to memorize all the Great Lakes. All you have to do is go on Google and there it is, you know. So why do I need to memorize that? You know, because there is something in appropriating things and taking them in and allowing them to touch you and touch your behavior and touch your heart. Everything is too virtual nowadays. I am the last holdout at the seminary. I teach pastoral courses. I use no PowerPoint. You see no PowerPoint today. I use no PowerPoint in my classroom because I told my students, this is about communication. This is pastoral ministry. You need to look at me. I need to look at you, and we need to talk to each other. And that is not going to be mitigated by your virtual self and my virtual self. This is human communication. And why do we do that? There are a million reasons why we do that. Because the Lord created us for relationship. He didn't create us for the internet, right? He created us for human-to-human relationship. He created the mother nursing her child at a distance where the baby's eyes can focus on that mother's face. And that child can see the love in that mother's face and can begin to mirror that experience. The Lord created the mother to hear that high tone of a cry that a father will say, I never heard the child cry in the middle of the night. But the mother hears it because that human voice signals to her that her child is in distress, and only she can hear those higher cry tones. The Lord created in the human mother the ability to talk in that high little squeaky voice that we all talk in when we talk to kids. Do you know what that does? That is done, first of all, cross-culturally, and that will lower a baby's heart rate. We are fearfully, wonderfully made for human communication. And all this virtual stuff, it's good, it can augment, but it can never replace. And this is the kind of stuff we need to say to our students. This is what we need to teach them. We need to help them understand that human to human, you know, I read an article not too long ago. Many of you as educators remember that classic work called Why Johnny Can't Read. Remember that work? Well, there's a new one out called Why Johnny Can't Read Social Cues. And we're going to speak a little to that in my second talk. But yeah, we really need to be engaging them and just, first of all, slow them down. Slow them down. Unplug them. You know, so important. And you know, I think we all have to admit that we're all just a little bit like Pavlovian dogs, aren't we? When we hear that phone go ding. And you know, no matter what we're doing, pick that up and just see who's calling or what's that all about. You know, that's something that we all, and we can model that. We need to model solitude. We need to model quiet. I'm on my soapbox now. Our students do not know how to pray. They're distracted. It's boring. It's just a different world. So we need to settle them, and we need to touch their hearts as much as we can, person to person. Thank you, sister.
Clarification, you were regarding education. You know, you said they're overeducated or they're not educated. So you're saying there's a space. But, you know, like you were given the example of they learned the square root in the second grade. So there's a space there, right?
Well, and that was what Margaret Mead was saying in the 70s already. So can you imagine what the explosion of knowledge is like now? There's so much accessibility. There's so much for them to grab onto and to know. But we can't let them be overwhelmed by that and appropriate nothing. You know, there have to be some things you can remember.
Is that why they're more in touch with the real?
Quite possibly, some of them might be. But, you know, something as simple as, and I mean, I'm going to really date myself here, but something as simple as memorizing nowadays, you know, there's a discipline to that. And, you know, there are people who are writing now that are saying self-regulation is the plague of the modern world. We don't regulate ourselves. We don't discipline ourselves anymore, you know. And so something as simple as teaching kids to memorize a poem. So when they're my age, I recently heard a jazz singer who is a black jazz singer singing. He's Catholic. He wears a St. Jude medal in his pierced ear and his many thousands of tattoos. He grew up in the slums of New Orleans, but he's his name is Aaron Neville, if you know him, maybe you do, very holy man, and he sang a very touching song that took me back to first grade, and he had put to words, to music, the poem that we all, many of us learned, "Lovely lady dressed in blue, teach me how to pray, God was just your little boy. And you know the way." See that? Look at that. Do you know how long that's been appropriated for some of us? That's been appropriated a long time. That's not something I had to go on the internet and look up. And we're not appropriating. And so it's, do you know what I mean by appropriating? We're not taking it in and making it part of our life and our value system. And so it becomes difficult to integrate things when we're just overwhelmed with millions of facts. What's significant? What means something to me? Yes.
I was thinking that unless they, these individuals whom we are seeking to form or foster in that work of formation, unless they literally come to some recognition of what this process is, what can be experienced, it's been mine, is that there'll be somebody that I'll want to say, this is not a bump shop. Mm-hmm. My work is not like to help you get rid of all the dents so that you're going to come out a perfect vehicle or something. But what I can find is a lack of comprehension or understanding of that deeper process of what it means to become more and more integrated within a particular religious institute. And so the things that might be said, the attempts to assist, can often be heard, but not even understood.
Yes. Well, thank you, sister, for those comments. And the way I would comment on that is to say that, you know, I think that one has to have a basic self-understanding and self-knowledge in order to be able to enter into that transformation process. To really, and I'm going to speak about this in our next talk, but to really understand self and to accept self is so critical. And that is more and more and more absent in the candidates that I see at the seminary. And I'm always telling my spiritual directors, help them believe that Jesus loves them. I'm begging you, do that. Help them do that, because that makes my job easier. And you know, that's just such a missing link. Such a missing link. So I think we did 15 minutes here. Yes, we have one more talk?
Well, no. We'll take a half-hour break.
Thank you.
Or we'll start again right at 11. I'm not sure we have a full half hour left. But
thank you.
At 11, we'll begin again. Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you very much.